It's time for security now. Steve Gibson is here, and we have a very big show for you. Lots of information, but most importantly, we're going to talk about the largest DDoS attack of all time, how it happened, why it happened, and what companies and, more importantly, server makers can do to stop it. That's next on Security Now.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is Security Now with Steve Gibson, episode 944, recorded October 17th, 2023. Abusing HTTP2 Rapid Reset. This episode of Security Now is brought to you by Melissa. More than 10,000 clients worldwide rely on Melissa for full-spectrum data quality and ID verification software. Make sure your customer contact data is up to date this holiday season. Get started today with 1,000 records cleaned for free at melissa.com/twit. And by Duo. Protect against breaches with a leading access management suite, providing strong multi-layered defenses to only allow legitimate users in. For any organization concerned about being breached and in need of a solution fast, Duo quickly enables strong security and improves user productivity. Visit cs.co/twit today for a free trial. And by Bitwarden. Get the open source password manager that can help you stay safe online. Get started with a free Teams or Enterprise plan trial, or get started for free across all devices as an individual user at bitwarden.com/twit. It's time for Security Now, the show where we cover your security and safety and privacy and all that good stuff online, sometimes offline as well, with this man. Now, I usually point to over my left shoulder, but
and I got
he's over to my right now. No, my left. Here he is, Stephen Gibson of GRC.com. For those that don't watch the video, I am at my mom's house doing the show from there instead of the usual studio. So we're a double box, you and I.
Yes, we are. And for anyone who's wondering, wait. What happened to part two of the top 10 most significant cybersecurity misconfigurations?
Yeah.
Was promised for this week. Well, I did say that unless something even bigger and more important and timely came along, that's what we would be doing. And wouldn't you know it, that's what happened. There is a serious new way of abusing the most, I was going to say the most recent HTTP protocol, but that's actually HTTP/3. This is HTTP, which hasn't been has not yet been widely deployed.
Right.
HTTP/2 is, and it's been given the big cloud providers a run for their money in for a while now. It is a serious new form of DDoS attack against HTTP/2 capable servers.
We had that story on Sunday on TWiT that the Google had suffered the largest DDoS attack of all time
by hugeness. I mean,
and I think that was HTTP/2, right?
That's what that was, that story. So yeah. We're gonna cover a bunch of our listeners' feedback and questions, which brings us some interesting topics such as: how have ValiDrive's first 10 days of life been going? And what more have we learned about the world of fraudulently fake USB thumb drives? Should passkeys be readily exportable, or are they better off being kept hidden and inaccessible? Why can't a web browser be written from scratch? Can Security Now listeners have SpinRite 6.1 early, like now?
Ooh.
Yeah.
What?
What was that app for filling a drive with crypto noise? And what's my favorite iOS one-time password app? And couldn't Google Docs HTML exported links being redirecting be a user privacy feature? After we address those terrific questions and a few more posed by our listeners, we're going to take a look, as I said, at the surprise emergence of a potent new HTTP2-specific DDoS attack. Is it exploiting a zero-day vulnerability, as Cloudflare claims, or is that just deflection?
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. Cloudflare, one of the biggest DDoS mitigation companies in the business.
Right.
So they would have some inside information.
They got caught with their DDoS down, baby.
They might have some incentive for dissembling. Oh, interesting stuff. And we also have one of the funniest pictures of the week ever. I snuck ahead. I confess I did. We'll get to all that in just a second. But first, a word from our sponsor, and we thank him so much. Melissa, you've heard me talk about Melissa, the contact data quality expert. This holiday season, it's even more important than ever to let Melissa help your business meet online shopping expectations, increase ROI, reduce waste and costs associated with lost and undeliverable packages, and improve overall customer satisfaction. We probably do more mailings over the holidays than any other time of the year, right? Well, and if you're a retailer, early preparedness is extremely important. It's not too early to start thinking about this. Here we are in October. Here are some of Melissa's tips to help you get started preparing for the busy season. Start by cleaning out your contact data with Melissa's data cleansing solutions. You want to get rid of all the old, stale, outdated data. And you don't want to get rid of those customers, but you want to replace the outdated data with verified, accurate information. Replace old addresses for people who've moved. Add new emails. People change emails all the time, or phone numbers. Make sure that you're getting a hold of the customer. By the way, it's not just, I always say customers, but it's also suppliers. It's vendors. It's the people you deal with, right? All those databases wear out. They go bad. They go stale over time. Customers, of course, want a seamless experience with delivery. I mean, this is the one time you don't want to punt a delivery, right? Make sure your business is meeting their expectations. Next day and 2-day delivery implementation in high demand, as always this year. Melissa ensures addresses are verified and standardized at checkout using their autocomplete tool. This is one of the main places that stuff gets messed up. You get a transposed digit in a zip code or a phone number. Or worse, an address. And sometimes those packages, they're just going to the wrong place. Not only does having a verified address at checkout ensure that that address is correct, you also are verifying that it's deliverable. You don't want to take an order for a direct address you can't deliver to. It also cuts down errors in keystrokes 75%. So your customer, if you've seen it probably, you probably used vendors that use Melissa. It's very popular. And you've seen it when you start entering the address and Melissa already knows and will even correct it and get the zip code +4 and all of that. That's Melissa. Makes your experience as a customer faster and easier. And it makes the supplier's experience much better because they're going to send it to the right address, right? One of the things Melissa can help with, offering bundles and cross-selling to existing customers, right? It's hard to get new customers. But you've already got a huge customer database, people who love your service, who love your product, who are going to maybe even order again. Being able to reach them effectively as we approach the holiday season is very important, especially since many of those people are shopping for others. Hey, I love this lawnmower. I got to get it from my buddy. Lawnmower's not a good example. Profiling the data in your customer database can give you a better understanding of your customer base and best-selling products. It can help you create more effective marketing strategies. Melissa can also enrich your customer data so you know more about their socials, their marital status, their demographics. That's very valuable when it comes to marketing to them. Matching and deduping data cleans the database as well. Gives you a complete 360-degree view of each customer with more personalized marketing, a better customer experience, and deduping is really important. It eliminates multiple mailings to the same person. That annoys them, and it wastes your time and money. Since 1985, Melissa has specialized in global intelligence solutions and contact data quality. Melissa takes care of your data, of course, like it's their own. They undergo continuous independent security audits. They publish those audits on their webpage, and they are SOC 2, HIPAA, and GDPR compliant. Make sure your customer contact data is up to date. Get started today with 1,000 records cleaned for free at melissa.com/twit. melissa.com/twit. And now our guy on the job for security and a guest. You're probably the number one place people send silly pictures these days. Right?
I think we've pretty much cornered the market on that. This one.
So good.
So what we have is at least a four-story building, because we can see four stories worth of it, although this, when the picture's cropped a little bit. And you know how code requires that you have often two exits from a domicile. In case a fire broke out near the front door, you need to have a back way out, right? Like the traditional fire escape. Well, that appears to be what we have here, because we see a line of back doors. You know, yeah. There's no numbers on the doors. They don't look like front doors. They look like, you know,
they're
back doors.
Yes.
Unfortunately, if you were to open the door and run out, that would be bad.
Wile E. Coyote off the cliff. Isn't
it? Yes. Because for a reason that's difficult to explain, the stairs are shifted off to the side. There's like a spiral staircase where each of the landings of the spiral would correspond with the height at the bottom of the door, like you'd expect, except that they're about, what, six feet off to the side? And you know, Leo, what occurred to me is that they're lined up with the windows. Because there's also windows off to the side. And anyway, I gave this picture the title Slavish Devotion to the Specifications. as if, like, maybe some, like, somebody was looking at the plans and got the windows and the doors exchanged.
I didn't stop to ask,
why are we putting the stairs over here where there's no doors?
You can see the memo to tenants saying, now, just a reminder, when you go out the fire escape, take a sharp right, okay? Very, very important. You know, somebody in the chat room said, and this might actually be right, that maybe they're moving, they're prefabbed and they're moving those into place. And some smart photographer got the shot before they actually got
moved over. That's good.
That would make sense. They do prefab those things. I know
that would explain it. So they tilted it up and it's against the wall.
Yeah,
and now they're going to move it over and then anchor it to something.
At least I hope that's the case. Because if they built it like that,
wow,
somebody ought to get fired.
Yeah, I don't think that would pass the code inspection. But let's see. How's your exit?
That's easy.
It.
When the inspector wants to see the exit, you just show them the door.
That's right.
See you through there.
See you later. That's right. Okay, so I wanted to follow up a bit on ValiDrive. We're 10 days out from its release, and we're currently seeing a 7-day moving average, which is what my server produces, of 2,443 downloads per day.
Wow.
With a total of 27,603 total when I looked this morning. So
that's amazing.
That download rate currently places it at the top among GRC's freeware goodies. It has managed to push GRC's always number one, which is the DNS benchmark. That's currently being downloaded 1,867 times per day. It's pushed it to the number two spot.
Yeah, although, but by the way, that's been out for years. That's pretty impressive.
The DNS benchmark has demonstrated somewhat astonishing endurance.
Yeah.
It's got more than 8.5 million downloads since its release. So,
well, I recommend it all the time. I mean, it's really
well, there isn't really an alternative. It is the right one. And it does run under Wine, so Linux people are able to run it.
Well, that's one problem I have with ValiDrive. You really have to do it on Windows, right?
Yes, you do. That's one of the questions that we'll be addressing here in a second. But anyway, so I think it's fair to say that the DNS benchmark has become a staple on the internet. And I expect that Valodrive may have similar long-term legs, although I would expect at probably a lesser average rate, you know, once the news of its existence has settled down.
Hope that the people selling crappy hard drives on Amazon don't figure out where you live, because you're kind of cutting into their business there, Steve.
Well, so for example, I got some feedback from someone whose handle is QQQ1. I don't know why. It's easy to type over there on the left-hand side of the keyboard.
Yeah, it is, actually.
Anyway, he said, I knew these would be trash. He said, quote, free gifts, unquote, as in gifts, unquote, with stuff we order. We have a large pile of them. And then he sent me in his tweet a screenshot of the Valodrive results. So the drive's declared size is 32 gig. The valid size is 512 meg. And so you can see in the graphic, there's like a little strip of green where there's actual storage, and then just the sea of red where there's nothing.
The point here that people who didn't hear your original discussion of this and why you did it is it's really easy to have the firmware report a larger size than is actually available.
Exactly. Exactly.
So you can make a cheap, 500 meg drive and have the firmware say, oh, no, this is 32 gigs. And the sad thing is a lot of software won't even question it. We'll just write to these non-existing sectors.
No software will. I mean, it will accept a format because formats no longer actually go out and read the data. A long format does, but even a long format won't catch it because the drive reports no error when you read from this non-existent memory. So, it pretends to be a 32 gig drive, but it only contains half a gig of non-volatile storage. So, what I was wondering was, okay, it's a free gift drive. Why lie about its size? It's free.
Well, it's really a gift horse, and you should look it in the mouth.
Yes. Yeah. So, as we know, the drive's electronics proactively lie, as you said, about the amount of storage that it contains. So it cannot be a mistake, right? I mean, this is deliberate.
Yeah.
It has to be deliberate fraud. So then I had the question, but a fraud perpetrated upon whom?
Right.
And in thinking about this further, in the case of such freebie giveaway drives, it occurred to me that the first target of this fraud is not those of us who receive these freebies.
No. Yeah.
We're the victims, but we're the secondary victims.
Right.
The primary victim is the entity, whomever it was, who purchased these as gifts.
Right.
In this instance above, they believed they were purchasing probably a huge quantity of 32 gigabyte drives, doubtless at a bargain quantity discount, to be used as appealing 32 gig giveaway drives. So the fraud was actually perpetrated upon them by the people from whom they purchased these drives. No one wants a free 512 megabyte drive anymore. It's like, what am I going to do with this? Store one photo on it,
exactly.
These days. So anyway, our takeaway is to be very cautious about the actual use of any drives that you buy for a bargain, at the checkout stand, as you're moving your groceries along, and there's a little, like a fish bowl of drives, and you can have one for a buck, or a drive that you may have ever received as a thoughtful thank you gift thrown in with something else.
For a long time, I said drives are getting so cheap, you're going to get them in boxes of Cap'n Crunch. That actually probably is true, but it won't be the drive you think you're getting.
Exactly.
Wow.
It'll be marked 32 gig. It'll format as 32 gig, and it'll look like it's storing your 32 gigs of files, but they're not there when it comes.
So it writes without error, and then it's only when you try to read it and there's nothing there that you go, oh.
Right.
And even then, you might not suspect. You might just think, I made a mistake.
No, it will be a valid. It'll even so. In order for Valid Drive to show, because I have read error and write error colors in the map. In order for it to show red, it had to Valid Drive wrote and read with no error. So no error was returned.
Wow.
The drive accepted the data from the operating system. Said thanks. I got it. And then when the operating system said, give it to me back, it said, here you go. Unfortunately,
well, how does Valid Drive know that it didn't work?
Because it uses a crypto random pattern in order to and puts that out and then verifies it when it asks for it back.
So the drive will say here, but what you get is nothing
or
some random bits that don't match the bits you wrote.
It's typically all zeros or all ones.
Okay.
And the problem is it'll give it. So the drive will give you the file back.
You won't get an error.
You know, try opening that in your image viewer and it's not going to be happy. Like, this is not a valid file. So anyway,
it's amazing how widespread this is. Last week you talked about how many drives on Amazon you bought that almost all of them.
I bought a dozen. They were all bad.
Yeah.
Every single one of them.
This is terrifying. Now, you said you're going to talk about other operating systems, so I'll let you go on. Because I would like to – I don't have a PC running Windows. So
Elaine said, hi, Steve. Thank you for your work on Valid Drive. I'd really like to test a few USB sticks with it, but I only have access to Linux systems. Is it possible to get this running on Ubuntu or some other distro? Okay, so Elaine and our listeners, I understand. The DNS benchmark – that I wrote was deliberately Wine compatible. I went out of my way to make sure that I wasn't doing anything there that Wine did not support on its Windows compatibility layer. So, and I spent some time on that. But Valid Drive's UI, which uses dynamic USB insert and removal events to determine which drive the user wishes to test, uses features that are outside of Wine's Windows compatibility set. So, if it was crucial for Valid Drive to run under Wine, I could probably arrange to somehow make that happen. But I've already spent more time on it than I plan to, and I'm chomping at the bit to get back to finishing SpinWrite. If it turns out to be seeing strong long-term use, I would be inclined, at once SpinWrite 6.1 is finished, to return to Valid Drive and give it a significant, you know, version 2.0 update. There are some other things I could do that, for the sake of expediency and not spending another few months on it, I said no, let's not go there. There are many people in the news group who are saying, hey, how about this and how about this and how about that.
You know, I'm sure somebody's asked this, but the one thing I would say would be useful if you just wrote a paragraph on the methodology. You don't have to say how to do it, but just what works to verify. You know, we're going to write this script, you know, whatever it is, and then maybe somebody can duplicate it on another platform. You wouldn't mind that, right? You're not making money on it.
No, I wouldn't mind that.
I think that what we need to do is understand, because there are ways you could do this that would not be a valid test. Like, for instance, saying, can I read it? Oh, I can read it. It's good.
Oh, yeah.
So
yeah.
You went the extra mile. So what is it that we need to do to really have a valid test? You've got all this data now as well on what works and what doesn't work.
One thing I should mention is that it does run, for example, under Parallels VM, even on an ARM Mac.
Oh, that's good to know. Oh,
yes.
Well, I would do that.
Yes.
Oh, okay.
It absolutely will.
Oh, I'm set.
Yeah, there is something known as safe emulation mode, which at least on an ARM Mac,
which you is have what
to
I have.
Turn, we have to turn on in order to get it to run.
So and you I turn put, on safe emulation mode. I thought it was really masking the reads and writes, but of course it can't be because you have to read and write data to a drive. You have to get out of the way and let that happen. So that makes sense. So if I run Windows on ARM in emulation mode on my Mac using Parallels, will still be able to run it. Oh,
yep. We've got people who are running it all the time.
That's good to know. Mm. That's great.
Yeah. Okay. So some feedback from our listeners. Mark Simo said, just visiting X to contact you. And he's Mark Simo/@marcos@twit.social, by the way.
Yeah. A good Mastodon user. Yeah.
So he said, regarding passkeys and their lack of easy exportability, QR codes, etc., have you ever thought that those exact features would make passkeys vulnerable for phishing and other social engineering attacks? They're hidden from normal users for a very good reason. Someone should now figure out what could be a phishing-resistant way to move them across ecosystems. Or we could all start using Squirrel.
Well, because you solved this already.
I did. I completely agree with Marco's observation. It is definitely a double-edged sword to make the passkeys less mysterious. And I have to say that, Leo, your comment about the lackluster success, to phrase it oddly, of passkeys heartened me a little bit. I've actually, not because I don't want the world to have a public key based network authentication system, but because the reason my Squirrel system has gone nowhere wasn't just me. You know, of course, that is the reason it's never going to go anywhere. But at least passkeys hasn't yet taken the world by storm, or if it had, I would have at least expected a little bit more from Squirrel, and I use the word yet, hasn't yet taken the world by storm, since I really do fully expect that this FIDO2 based passkeys public key system will someday supplant the use of secret passwords. But probably not in my lifetime. Seriously, not in my lifetime. All okay. of the evidence suggests, and I'm feeling great right now, so I'm planning to be around for a while.
Take off in the next 10 years, it's going to be something else, don't you think? You think it's going to be around?
No, I think they did it right. I think, and my God, if it takes 10 years to get this thing going, we don't have another 10 years to go for plan B. So, seriously, all the evidence suggests that implementing this sort of sweeping change really will be that slow. But, the reason I put all that time into Squirrel was I said, well, no one had done it. And if no one does, then it's never going to happen. Well, my system's never going to happen anyway. But at least a public key system option now exists. And the problem is, it just from the user standpoint, there's nothing that's obviously better about it. As you said, Leo, we already have password managers. This problem has been solved. It's not solved well, but we're kind of limping along with a few arrows in our back, some of us, but it's at least it's obvious how it works.
Yeah. So, everybody's already gone the extra mile to get that working.
Yep.
And if they haven't, that's even going to be harder to get them to switch over, because they're just entering their pet's name and their birthday on every site. And they say, well, what's wrong? There's no they don't see a problem. So what are you fixing?
Yeah. So Michael Molony, he tweeted, aren't passkeys meant to be a device verification like SSH keys? While you could copy them between devices, best security is to generate them on the device you need to authorize. So if that device gets stolen or hacked, you can revoke the key for that device. Also, if the device is hacked, logs are way more useful if it shows Paul's iPhone rather than Paul's key. And then he has to redo every passkey device. He said, aside from backups, I hope passkeys stay non-transferable. When you put your PIN or fingerprint in your phone, you're basically unlocking all the sites this passkey has access to. Same as when you sign into your PC with your password that has all your SSH keys. Okay, so that's true. And I think it's a good point. You know, this would be roughly equivalent to having multiple separate username password pairs for logging into one's bank account with a different username password pair stored in each device. Then, if a device was compromised, the usernames and passwords that were being used by the compromised device could be independently disavowed and disabled. Now, while that's good in theory, that really raises the level of management complexity to a whole new level. You know, yes, there's a lot of power in that approach, but also a huge amount of responsibility for keeping track of who's on first. And, you know, okay, yes, a crazy power user could do it. But, you know, we can't even get anybody to use a passkey, let alone, manage them all separately. Brian M. Franklin said at SGGRC, maybe it is still possible to write a new web browser with even better features. And then he quoted a thread in X, which I'm now calling it, where from someone named AKHIL, who tweeted, here's the multiplayer browser engine I've been working on in action. And I have to say, I love the name because it's multiplayer. He named it the Braid browser, as in, you know, B-R-A-I-D, like a, you know, like something braided, which I think is a very cool name for it. Anyone who's curious can go to braidbrowser.com, BRAIDBROWSER.com.
I wish it didn't sound so much like brave.
Yes,
so
that is
braid, that's a, like in hair.
There is a collision there.
Yeah.
Okay, so here we've got a guy who wrote a browser. Well, there's browsers and then there's browsers. I love the idea of the creation of hobby browsers. You know, it's a modern take on the idea of a hobby operating system. You know, and a bunch of hobby operating systems have been created. In fact, I carefully considered basing SpinRite's future upon a few of them, but lack of support for booting on UEFI-only systems ultimately led me to the embedded RTOS 32 OS that I've talked about before. Similarly, while I think it's possible to create a functional outline of a modern browser, the task, as I've said, has grown in size such that it's similar to that of creating a fully functional operating system. You know, yeah, there's hobby browsers, and then there's production scale Chromium, Firefox, and Safari, and that's it. So anyway, the guy, I don't know what this thing actually does. I played the video that was there in X, and there was two cursors moving around separately.
Ooh, thus, what a cool feature!
If you're ambidextrous, maybe you don't want to. Maybe you keep one cursor over on the left and one on the right, then you don't have to go so far. I don't know. Anyway, whatever
it is.
That's
the kind of thing a hobbyist browser would do.
That's right, because that's what we really need. We need more cursors on our browser.
I'd be very careful, because really the browser is the primary vector for malware into your machine.
I know.
And it's really easy to make a mistake in a browser. You know, maybe people are using Chromium as their base for all the
this
rendering.
This guy claims it's a million lines of C++. Oh, and you know, Leo, every one of them is perfect. Oh, every one of them million
that
lines.
That scares me.
Oh.
That scares me.
Yeah.
There's a new browser called Arc, A-R-C, from Arc, the browser company. But it's Chromium, and then they're doing the GUI on top of it, the Chrome, as it were. And that's a little more doable. I don't know if I'd trust an individual to write a browser. That's a hard.
We got Mozilla. We got Chromium. We got Safari.
Yeah,
I think that's it.
Yeah.
Tech gift horse tweeted, "Hi Steve, longtime listener, first time DMer. Regarding episode 493, the last week, where you introduced that Google was embedding tracking links in Google Docs exports, I recently noticed that Google is also doing this in calendar invites. No privacy. I'm not sure if they were trialing it in Google Docs HTML exports, and as now it is expanding, but I thought it was noteworthy. I also wanted to say that you and Leo have inspired me to start my master's in cybersecurity.
Oh, that's great.
Keep the pods coming and keep up the great work. Can't wait for your forthcoming email option so I can delete this bogus Twitter account. Sincerely, Sean.
People are going over to Twitter just to talk to you.
Yeah, they are. I'd seen enough of that. And that was why, you know, when I said I'm leaving Twitter, what I meant really was I'm not going to make everyone use Twitter as a means of contacting
that's
me.
That's the problem. Yeah,
so just as soon as I have SpinRite 6.1 ready for rollout, I'll let everyone here know, of course, to get the official final. You know, that's the super easy communication path, Leo, that you and I have built with all of our listeners every week. Then I'll begin work on bringing up a new email facility so that I'm able to get the word out to all of 6.0's current owners. And part of that work will be to create a new means for me to send announcements to my Twitter followers and also create a means for them to send me the equivalent of private DMs. Brent Russell said, "Hi, Stephen," being formal. The aunt calls me Mr. Gibson. So, yeah, this is different. This is Hi, Stephen.
Aunt doesn't call me Mr. Laporte. He calls me Leo. But everybody else is Mr., which is
good. Yeah, I'm Mr. Gibson.
Well brought up Southern boy.
Here we have Hi, Stephen. And it actually is my given name, S-T-E-V-E-N. So very formal.
We didn't know that.
I realize that this is a request out of the blue. But my hard disk is failing on my main machine. I own a copy of SpinRite. And then he provided in the tweet his code, which is the SpinRite serial number. But the disk is set up as GPT, which 6.0 does not support. Any chance you can give me a pre-release of 6.1 to run, please? There's nothing critical on the drive, but if it dies, it will take some time to bring it all back. So, of course, Brett, and this goes for everyone. If you go to grc.com/prerelease.htm, just prerelease.htm, what you'll get is a little form. Enter your current SpinRite 6.0 serial number, which is presented whenever SpinRite is run. And I just verified that Brett's code works perfectly for him. So when you do that, you'll receive a link to download your own personalized and licensed copy of the latest pre-release of version 6.1. What you'll get at this point is the DOS executable. Since I haven't yet built it all into the Windows boot prep thing, that's coming next. So just place that DOS executable, I think it's 95K, onto your SpinRite boot drive and let her rip. The current pre-release expires at the end of November, so that's 6 weeks from now, and I'm sure we'll have updated releases before then, so you can just come back and get an update, or just retard the machine's date, you know, if you want to buy yourself some more time. At this point, I'm 100% certain that SpinRite is safe to use. The reason is, I just checked, and we have exactly 800 registered SpinRite pre-release testers who've been using and pounding on all of the SpinRite pre-releases. Okay. I've taken great pains to be very careful along the way, and no one has ever experienced any data loss at any point. So this thing's ready for the world. I just need to tie up a bunch of loose ends, which, you know, any 3-year project of this complexity is going to have. So, you know, that's where we are. But, you know, absolutely, all of our listeners, anybody who has SpinRite, you're welcome to go grab 6.1. It's all but done. You know, just a few last things we'll need to get changed. Ray Franklin tweeted, "Steve, I've looked through the current show notes for the reference wipe drive with encryption. What's the program to effectively wipe a drive with random data?" And that's Veracrypt. And I tweeted him the link. It's at veracrypt.fr because it's French. And you could use it as we've talked about, basically to fill your drive with cryptographically secure noise. It's actually encrypting what you have already there, but if you throw away the key, no one's ever going to get it. Marcus, whose handle is BadassBG, he said, "Hi, Steve. I just had a quick question. I heard you say that you do not use Authy for two-factor authentication, and I was wanting to know what you do use. Thanks." So being an Apple ecosystem person for mobile, I use an app called OTP Auth, and I love it. It's clean, simple, and is very widely praised. And I, for anyone who can't find it easily, I got a link in the show notes.
I also just I'll plug for something that's both iOS and Android, which I've been using. Also free, also open source, TuFas, or maybe it's TuFas. I don't know. The number
no,
two,
F-A-S,
TuFas, TuFas. And what's nice about it is it will back up an encrypted blob with your secrets to either Google Drive or iCloud. So it makes, you know, this is an issue for me. And one of the reasons we used Authy is so that we can move, because I get a new phone, many new phones all the time. And so the ability to move is very, very important to me. And
especially be able to move cross-platform.
Yes, exactly.
Nice.
Yeah. Well, I just installed both a new Pixel 8 Pro and a new iPhone 14 Pro. And 2FAS worked on both. And I was able to import those secrets. And it was really nice. And it looks good. It's here. I'll show you. It's pretty. It's a pretty... I don't know about yours, but this one's pretty. And it uses Face ID to... By the way, there's all my two factors.
Yeah, well, they're going to be
They're useless in 30 seconds. Use them quick, kids.
That is very pretty.
It's very pretty. You click it and it will copy it to the clipboard. It goes red when it's about to expire and then it generates
a new
one.
OAuth does not do
and it
that.
And it can sort alphabetically or in other ways, which is also nice. It's just the one I use. But 2FAS, to each his own. The nice thing is you don't have to use a paid or a solution from Google or Microsoft. You can, you know, this is a standard. TOTP is a standard, and there are lots of people that make software.
And finally, Henning said, "Dear Steve, when listening to SN 943 again last week, I have a different explanation for why Google is rewriting links in Google Drive documents published as HTML pages. Prevent the leakage of the document's URL through referrer information. Though the Drive documents are public, they're hidden by their long obscure URL. But the referrer info can reveal the URL in the server logs of the embedded links. The additional step through a second Google service hides this information." So first of all, Henning, that's a neat thought. That hadn't occurred to me. But these links were present in offline HTML exports of the doc. So wherever the HTML was being served from would be appearing in a referrer header. Also, if this was a favor that Google was doing for us to protect our privacy, then their referring link URLs would not have been loaded down with unique tracking parameters in order to see, you know, exactly what link it is that someone has clicked on in the future. So much as I love the idea that they might be protecting us, that doesn't appear to be their intent here.
There's been a lot of conversation about Google rewriting search queries as well.
Drives me nuts when and they even show you the true link, but then that's not what you get when you click on it.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that, let's face it, they're an advertising based business, and the need to monetize through advertising kind of permeates everything, all these free services. As a result, I think, you know, if you want privacy, maybe, I pay $25 a month for a advertising free search.
A month?
Well, it doesn't have to be a month.
Okay.
Yeah, no, it is. I think you can get it for $5. I pay a little more because they have a browser and stuff. But Kaggy is very good results, Google quality results, but no ads, no targeting, none of that. But they don't have Docs. They don't have Google Drive. They don't have all these other great features. And that's the problem. But all that stuff's free. And there's you got to monetize it. I understand.
So, Leo, let's take our second break, and then we're going to get into...
Speaking of monetizing. You know, I am not against ads. We wouldn't exist if it weren't for advertising. We're very careful. But the other thing that, and I think, you know, we've talked before about the fact that podcast advertising is getting tough. And I think a lot of that is because advertisers and especially ad agencies are expecting the kind of tracking Google, Facebook, and Apple do. And we won't do that. We can't do it really with a podcast. RSS feeds, you know, the only thing we know about you is that your IP address when you download the podcast. We can't get anything else. We do put redirects in, but they're
in order to count.
Yeah, in order to count. But and we do, and I should explain, because people might wonder, that we use also a service called PodSites that we think is the best compromise between getting advertisers. Look, they won't buy ads at all if we don't do this. But what happens is PodSites we redirect through them, so they get all our IP addresses. And then the advertiser sends them, does not get those IP addresses. That's kept secret by PodSites, but sends to PodSites their logs from all of their landing pages. And then PodSites goes, well, 43% of the people who downloaded that podcast went to your website, but neither side gets the other's information. We don't get the advertiser's IP addresses and they don't get our IP addresses. PodSites, we have to trust them that keeps that, but that's their business, keeps that secret. That is tracking and we have to do it. That's how, you know, advertisers, if they don't get some sort of feedback, it used to be for a long time, just using that special URL was sufficient. It's been a long time since that was sufficient. And frankly, their podcast network's going out of business right now. WNYC is just basically shutting down its entire podcast operation because advertisers are, you know, they say, well, we can get so much more from Google. We get so much more from Facebook. Why can't you give us this? Well, we can't. It's a podcast.
I guess we really are in a world where metrics is what it's about. It's like measure.
Absolutely. And I think to some degree it's mistaken. I understand advertisers want to know, well, you know, how effective is my ad? But tracking, I'm not convinced that ad tracking gives you better ad results, to be honest.
No.
So I think that, you know, but the problem is it's what they believe. Good luck convincing them otherwise. So we have to go along to get along. We give them as little information as possible. We do everything we can to protect your privacy. As that becomes less and less valuable to them, we're losing advertisers constantly.
we subscribe in our household to YouTube TV, and sometimes there will be a commercial break that'll instead be just some relaxing,
yeah,
you know,
enjoy
whatever
this
it
moment
is.
Of zen.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. The moment of zen. And, yeah. And Lori first asked me, she said, what is that about? I said, well, Google knows who we are and they've decided they don't want to pay to show us that ad because we're not buying diapers. So,
yeah, that's part of it. Advertisers don't want to, you know, Wanamaker famously said, I know 50% of my ads work, but I just don't know which 50%.
And, well, now Lori's all creeped out. Whenever one of those comes up, she says, like, they know who we are.
You could tell her this is what's going on. You're watching YouTube TV probably. And YouTube TV is, in effect, a cable company. Cable gets ad avails, local ad avails that they will put in your local plumber. So when you watch your cable TV, there'll be Mike the plumber in there after the ad for Toyota. That's a local ad sell made by the local cable company. Well, YouTube TV is not selling that. So it's a hole in the programming where somebody's ad's supposed to go. You're right. It's probably, I don't know how hard Google is working to sell it, but they haven't sold it for one reason or another. Maybe they don't want to reach you, but it's not about you. It's about, that's a local ad that they just don't have sold. So they,
well, and the other thing I've noticed is if you back up over an ad you've seen, then you'll get the moment of zen. They won't show you the ad again.
Oh, that's clever. Oh, maybe they're smarter than I realized.
I think they're pretty smart.
They don't want to show it twice because then they have to pay twice.
Yeah. Exactly.
It's a mess out there. It's one of the reasons we push Club Twit so hard. You know, I think you remember when we started, I really wanted this to be listener supported. But we never were able to get more than $8,000 or $9,000 a month, which wasn't enough to pay me and you. So we have a studio and all that stuff. So eventually we did have to, and this was the first show that had advertising on it. Thank you, Steve. We did have to turn to that, but increasingly, I think we're going to have to turn back to the audience and say, look, if you like these shows and you want to keep these shows going and you want to keep Twit going, join Club Twit, $7 a month. That's all it takes. That's all we make. That's all an advertiser, you know, would pay us for you. In fact, it's a lot, frankly, probably a lot. I don't know. I have to think about it. I don't know if it's less or more. We didn't want to charge you more. Maybe we should. Facebook says they want $14 a month. Not to show you ads in the EU. They're going to do that. So maybe we're not charging enough, but it's most we feel fair charging you. You get ad-free versions of this show and all the shows. You get the Discord channel and you get all the other stuff we do in the club, including the book club and all of that. So,
and then you don't get the following commercial break.
You don't get what I'm about. You don't get this. You don't even get an ad for Club Twit because you're already a member. I don't want to advertise you. Right. Enjoy this moment of zen. If I had a bear catching salmon in a stream, I would show you that right now, but I don't. Actually, somebody the other day wrote to us, said, how can I get rid of the ads on the live show? And I said, I can't. You're not.
Without a time machine.
You wanted a moment of zen, maybe.
Without a time machine.
We don't have a way of doing that. Sorry. Just listen to the podcast and you'll get ad free. twit.tv/clubtwit if you're not a member. It would really help us out. I appreciate it. Thank you for letting me take some time out of this show. Now let me talk about Cisco and Duo. Oh, Duo is great for security. It protects against breaches with the leading access management suite. Look, strong multi-layer defenses and innovative capabilities only allow legitimate users in, and they keep bad actors out. For any organization concerned about being breached that needs protection fast, Duo quickly enables strong security. But here's the thing that's cool, while also improving user productivity. Now, you might scratch your head when you hear that, but let me explain. Duo prevents unauthorized access with multi-layered defenses and modern capabilities that thwart sophisticated malicious access attempts. And here's the key. Duo enables high productivity by only requiring authentication when needed. If it knows you're you, or for, you know, the risks levels low, it will let you in a lot faster. It gives you swift, easy, secure access, increases authentication requirements in real time when the risk increases, and uses all the technologies. You know, we probably could convince them to use Squirrel. It's using strong MFA, passwordless, single sign-on, trusted endpoint verification, all of this so that they can give you high security without getting in the way, you know, without reducing productivity. Duo helps you implement zero trust principles by verifying users and their devices in the least intrusive but the most secure way possible. Start your free trial. Sign up today at cs.co/twit, cs.co/twit.
Back to okay, you, so abusing HTTP2 rapid reset. As I said last week, we would be continuing with the second part of our look into the top 10 cybersecurity misconfigurations if something bigger and more important didn't bump it to the following week. Well, something did indeed. So we'll do the second part of the top 10 cybersecurity misconfigurations if something doesn't again bump it into the following week. But today, we're going to talk about an interesting surprise. The headline about this, which first caught my attention, was on Cloudflare's blog. That headline read, HTTP/2 zero-day vulnerability results in record-breaking DDoS attacks. Mm. So, you know, yeah, what? The idea of there being a newly discovered zero-day vulnerability in a core internet protocol such as HTTP2 would be huge news if it were true. For the rest of the podcast, we're going to explore what has happened and decide to what degree this is actually true. And as always, the devil is in the details, and these details are both interesting and important. So, a few lines into their coverage, Cloudflare wrote, Cloudflare has mitigated a barrage of these attacks in recent months. So my first reaction was to question their use of the term zero day if they've been doing something for several months. You know, but, you know, after wondering whether it might be an abuse or an overuse of the term, I suppose it's correct if they first learned of this unsuspected problem through an attack. You know, we've settled upon the definition of zero day as being the exploitation of any previously unknown vulnerability. Or stated another way, the first indication we have of there being some specific vulnerability is not when we find it through examination or when it's reported by a responsible researcher, but when we're surprised by something happening that we didn't believe to be possible. So, yeah, it would probably be correct for this to be considered a zero-day vulnerability in the version 2 HTTP protocol if indeed it was a vulnerability in the HTTP 2 protocol, which, surprisingly, is not the case. So it is to Cloudflare's benefit, as Leo, exactly as you said at the top of the show, since they are in the DDoS protection business, to characterize this as a surprising zero-day vulnerability in HTTP 2. That deflects the blame to the protocol when it appears that the true culprit is implementation. That, you know, the HTTP 2 protocol is not to blame because there's a difference between a vulnerability and the abuse of a feature that's exacerbated by Cloudflare's internally decoupled serial processing multi-proxy architecture.
This is interesting.
That's what made it such a problem. And it applies to the cloud providers because the way they've distributed the workflow interacted with this feature. So as I think the evidence will show, and Google was much more forthcoming, as we'll see, this is more about something that Cloudflare's behind-the-scenes request processing architecture was ill-suited to handle than the exploitation of any previously unknown vulnerability in HTTP 2. It's a clever and, in retrospect, probably foreseeable and maybe even inevitable leveraging of a feature in HTTP 2. So, you know, I don't mean to jump on Cloudflare too much about this, but characterizing this as a zero-day vulnerability in HTTP 2 is really not accurate or fair. Okay, so let's back up a bit. Let's start with a very quick background review of layered network design, and then a quick history of HTTP. We refer to HTTP, you know, the Hypertext Transfer Protocol, thus HTTP, as an application-level protocol, also known as a Layer 7 protocol, because that's as high as the layers go, because after we've finally finished building up layer upon layer of the various underlying enabling protocols, we finally get to HTTP, which was the whole point, you know, and it's there where something finally happens and gets done. So what do we mean by layer upon layer? At the bottommost level or layer, we have an agreement about wires and voltages and clock rates and like signal transition times, you know, and those are used to signal the transmission of individual discrete zeros and ones. That's typically referred to as the physical layer. You know, that's as physical as it can get. Like, what's the voltage on the wire and what does it mean? Then, with that agreed upon, we describe the groupings of those ones and zeros to form packets of data, which are addressed between physical hardware endpoints on a single local network. This is then the Ethernet protocol. And those Ethernet packets, in turn, contain IP, Internet Protocol packets, which carry the addresses of endpoints on the global Internet. And inside those IP packets are TCP packets, where the TCP protocol is used to manage the numbered, sequential, byte-oriented, reliable flow of data between those specific virtual ports on the devices specified by their IP addresses on the global network. And finally, the data that flows back and forth under the watchful eye of the TCP protocol is formatted as specific queries and responses in accordance with the top-level application protocol, HTTP. So that's the layering all the way up from the physical layer to layer 7, the application layer. And over the decades since their initial definitions, all of these protocols have seen some tuning, you know, some tweaking and evolution in their definition, you know, as they interacted with the real world. And that's certainly been true for HTTP. With a bit of editing by me for clarification, here's how Wikipedia briefly sums up HTTP's evolution. They wrote, "Development of HTTP was initiated by Tim Berners-Lee at CERN in 1989 and summarized in a simple document describing the behavior of a client and a server using the first HTTP version, which was 0.9. That version was subsequently developed, eventually becoming the public 1.0. Development of early HTTP RFCs began a few years later in a coordinated effort by the IETF, that's our Internet Engineering Task Force, and the W3C, W3 meaning World Wide Web, and C for Consortium, with work later moving exclusively back to and now at the IETF. HTTP/1, and it's shown as a /1 rather than a V1 because HTTP/1 is actually what's sent over the wire with each query to specify the format of everything that will follow. So you need to specify the version right up front so that the recipient is able to know how to interpret everything that's going to come. So version 1.0 was finalized and fully documented in 96. It quickly evolved into version 1.1 a year later in 1997, after which its specifications were updated in 99, 2014, and even just last year in 2022. Its secure variant, HTTPS, is now used, as we know, by more than 80% of websites, writes Wikipedia. Now, HTTP2, which is the topic for today, published first in 2015, so it's already 8 years old. It provides a more efficient expression, and we'll be talking about the sufficiency in a minute, of HTTP semantics on the wire. As of April 2023, HTTP2 is used by 39% of websites. So as of April this year, just shy of 40% of all websites offer HTTP2. And it's supported by almost all web browsers, representing over 97% of web users. So, you know, all the popular browsers do it now. It's also supported by major web servers over TLS using an application layer protocol negotiation known as an ALPN extension, where TLS 1.2 or newer is required. And just to round this out for the sake of completion, we actually drop TCP as the transport protocol for HTTP in favor of the faster to set up yet less feature rich UDP when we're using HTTP3, which is technically out there now, though not yet widely adopted. HTTP3, of course, is the successor to HTTP2. That was published just last year. It's now available from 25% of all websites, says Wikipedia, and it's at least partially supported by most web browsers. As I mentioned, unlike all of its TCP-based predecessors, HTTP3 does not run on top of TCP. Instead, it uses QUIC, which runs on top of UDP. Support for HTTP 3 was added to Cloudflare and Google Chrome first and is also enabled in Firefox. HTTP 3 has lower latency for today's web pages, which are pulling information together through many separate widespread sources. If HTTP 3 is enabled on the server, such pages, says Wikipedia, will load faster than with HTTP 2, which is in turn faster than HTTP 1.1. In some cases, as much as three times faster than HTTP 1.1. Okay. So now that we have the lay of the land, let's look at what took Cloudflare and others by surprise a few months back. There's a bit of, I guess it's marketing bragging going on here from Cloudflare, but mostly a lot of good information. And I'll insert a little bit of editorializing as we go. So Cloudflare wrote earlier today, and this was posted exactly 1 week ago on the 10th of October, they said Cloudflare, along with Google and Amazon AWS, disclosed the existence of a novel zero-day vulnerability dubbed the HTTP/2 Rapid Reset Attack. And they wrote, Cloudflare wrote, this attack exploits a weakness in the HTTP 2 protocol to generate enormous hypervolumetric distributed denial of service, you know, DDoS attacks. Cloudflare, they said, has mitigated a barrage of these attacks in recent months, including an attack three times larger than any previous attack we've ever observed, which exceeded 201 million requests per second. Since the end of August 2023, so that's just a couple of months ago, Cloudflare has mitigated more than 1,100 other attacks with over 10 million requests per second and 184 attacks that were greater than our previous DDoS record of 71 million RPS requests per second. And again, now these new attacks, 201. So nearly three times those 184 attacks that were greater than their previous DDoS record of 71 million. And I should note that a similar stat from Google about this put it at just shy of 400 million requests per second. I think it's 390 something, as I recall. So I'll pause here just to note that there are several different ways to measure or characterize DDoS attacks. Traditionally, attacks leveraged bandwidth flooding and saturation. You know, just pure bandwidth. The incoming network links to a server would be so saturated with packet traffic that a site's upstream routers would be overwhelmed as they were aggregating the traffic being aimed at a destination server, so overwhelmed with bogus packets that legitimate packet traffic stood little chance to get through to the server. It was just a matter of, you know, a matter of numbers. If you've got 100 bogus packets for every good one, there's a 1% chance that the good one's going to get through. So essentially, the server's services are being denied. And thus the term denial of service, of course. But as we know, some time ago, web pages shifted from being simple static dumps of a previously written textual page. You know, for example, my own GRC site remains that way to this day. It's just simple static HTML. But most web services switched over to being the public-facing aspect of a content management system, a CMS of some sort. Under this new website paradigm, any incoming HTTP query is fielded by some sort of code running on the server. That code examines the query details and assembles the page which will be returned to the client on the fly. And this, in turn, typically involves multiple queries to a back-end relational database of some kind, typically a SQL server. The point of this is that under this new content management paradigm, replying to a query for a simple page, what looks like a standard HTML page, consumes server-side compute resources in order to pull the various components of the page together for its return to the client. The other thing is that in the earliest days of this new approach, these on-the-fly page assembly systems were not often very efficient. So each query, especially deliberately complex queries, which, you know, might be requiring a lot of back-end database work to pull a complex page together, could be quite costly to answer or to reply to. Naturally, it didn't take the bad guys long to figure this out, after which they switched their attack tactics from flooding a server's raw bandwidth pipeline with what could well just be noise, it didn't really matter what the packets, you know, contained, to loading the server down with actual valid queries, each of which could be quite expensive for it to answer. Thus, we went from thinking of DDoS attacks in terms of bits per second to requests per second, because it was the request that was expensive to handle, not just a bandwidth flood. Now, I take issue with Cloudflare's characterization of this as an attack which, quote, exploits a weakness in the HTTP2 protocol. That's not what's been happening. As we'll see, these new attacks exploit some new features of HTTP2, which were added to make the protocol much faster overall. But it turns out that these new features are subject to abuse. And if a server's query processing chain is not really explicitly designed to handle these new features, it can be forced into collapse by attackers. This is where we'd say it's not a bug, it's a feature, and we'd mean it. So Cloudflare continues. They said, this 0-day, which, okay, it was a surprise, provided threat actors with a critical new tool in their Swiss Army knife of vulnerabilities to exploit and attack their victims. At a magnitude that has never been seen before. While at times complex and challenging to combat, these attacks allowed Cloudflare the opportunity, to develop purpose-built technology to mitigate the effects of the zero-day vulnerability. In other words, whoops, they got caught with their DDoS down and needed to do, you know, up their technology in order to deal with this. And, you know, as again, we're going to see, and I'll shortly provide ample evidence to back it up, this is not really a vulnerability. And I am a little disappointed in Cloudflare's approach to this. We all know that I'm a big fan of Cloudflare, but I believe they took the wrong tact on this one. So they said, in late August of this year, our team at Cloudflare noticed a new zero-day vulnerability developed by an unknown threat actor that exploits the standard HTTP2 protocol, a fundamental protocol that's critical to how the internet and all websites work, meaning HTTP, and now 2 is a lot better. This novel zero-day vulnerability attack, dubbed Rapid Reset, leverages HTTP2's stream cancellation feature by sending a request, then immediately canceling it over and over. By automating this trivial request, cancel pattern at scale, threat actors are able to create a denial of service and take down any server or application running the standard implementation of HTTP2. Furthermore, one crucial thing to note about the record-breaking attack is that it involved this attack that was bringing down Cloudflare's very strong pre-existing DDoS defenses. They said consisted of roughly 20,000 machines in a modestly sized botnet. They said Cloudflare regularly detects botnets that are orders of magnitude larger than this, comprising hundreds of thousands and even millions of machines. For a relatively small botnet to output such a large volume of requests with the potential to incapacitate nearly any server or application supporting HTTP2 underscores how menacing this vulnerability is for unprotected networks.
So I had assumed that this was some sort of massive amplification attack, because previous attacks have had to have massive botnets in order to do this.
Right.
Why is it that this HTTP2 cancel request, rapid reset request, can't be more easily blocked? If it's only 20,000 IP addresses it's coming from, how come you can't just mitigate it? I don't understand.
That actually is the strategy that's the only strategy. And I wind up saying exactly that.
Okay,
the only strategy that I think makes sense.
Yeah.
You jumped ahead.
Okay.
because thank God TCP cannot have its source address spoofed, right? You need to have a full communication link that is confirmed on each end, so you do know the IP address of every bot that's attacking you.
So previous attacks were much simpler. They were often SYNAC floods, where a bot would say, "Hello," and then your server would have to say, "Hello." And you'd start the conversation, at which point that server, that client would go, "Never mind. Hello."
And that's actually a good analogy to this attack. But it's upped a level where it's not just a SYN which is initiating a TCP connection. It's actually a request that is initiating back-end work.
So there's a lot of work because it's reset. You're asking it to reset the thread. So it's more than just, you know, hello, are you there?
It's more than just a single packet being received.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm gonna make three points. First, I hope it still astonishes us when Cloudflare writes, quote, "Cloudflare regularly detects botnets that are orders of magnitude larger than 20,000, comprising hundreds of thousands or even millions of machines." Just think about that. This kind of power in the hands of miscreants is fundamentally destabilizing. Because the internet is so powerful and because it mostly works so well, we've allowed ourselves to gradually grow to become utterly dependent upon its presence. But last week we noted Microsoft was observing around 1,700 DDoS attacks per day. So there are websites that are occasionally denied the sort of reliability that the internet has to offer because someone somewhere just says, "No, we want you off the net. We're not happy with something you just did, so we're going to punish you."
Well, people might remember back in the day, Steve had this happen to him.
Yep.
It was going on during the show.
Yep.
And it was just, it's just a vandalism of a company.
Well, it turned out it was because I had those DDoS attack reports on my site, and so they thought I was bragging in some way, when in fact I was not. And when I removed those pages, the attack stopped.
Oh, that's very interesting.
It wasn't me saying, "Nanny, nanny, nanny, you can't get me." It was like, "Ow, I just got blasted off the internet."
Yeah.
So the second point I wanted to highlight was that Cloudflare witnessed by far the largest attack they have ever experienced, which was produced by what is unfortunately now considered to be a relatively modest size botnet consisting of only around 20,000 individual clients. Since this sort of attack rides on TCP, the attacker's source IPs cannot be spoofed since TCP requires confirmation of packet round trips before the query can be sent. So Cloudflare has the specific IP of every bot that was attacking it. That's how it knows how many, because, it can count.
Right.
And the last point is that since this was a new form of abuse to which HTTP2 is prone, every one of these bots needed to be updated with a specific module designed to implement this attack against its target. So someone somewhere figured this out, wrote the code to do this, then either established a new botnet for this purpose or caused an existing modest-sized updatable botnet to be updated to add this new form of attack to its bag of tricks. They said, Cloudflare said, threat actors used botnets in tandem with the HTTP2 vulnerability, again, I'll take issue with that characterization, but we'll get there in a second, to amplify requests at rates we have never seen before. As a result, our team at Cloudflare experienced, I love this phrase here, some intermittent edge instability. Intermittent edge instability, right. In other words, we're all about DDoS protection, but this one got us.
Yeah.
Because we had never seen anything like it, and our back-end architecture was ill-equipped to handle it at the time. And in fact, they did publish a chart where it was like up to 80% of their connections were having trouble because, I mean, this thing really clogged up their network.
Well, that makes sense since you said 80% of all servers use HTTP2. It was able to hit them all, basically.
Well, I mean, so their entire customer base, you know, their whole front end is HTTP2 equipped.
If you're using Cloudflare, it is HTTP2.
Yeah, you have HTTP2 front facing. So they said, while our systems were able to mitigate the overwhelming majority of incoming attacks, the volume overloaded some components of our network, impacting a small number of customers' performance with intermittent 4XX and 5XX errors, all of which were quickly resolved. Right. Once we successfully mitigated these issues and halted potential attacks for all customers, our team immediately kicked off a responsible disclosure process, meaning for several months, there's been stuff going on behind the scenes that no one knew about until Tuesday when this was officially revealed in a coordinated disclosure. They said, we entered into conversations with industry peers to see how we could work together to help move our mission forward and safeguard the large percentage of the internet that relies on our network prior to releasing the news of this vulnerability to the general public. They wrote, there's no such thing as a perfect disclosure. Thwarting attacks and responding to emerging incidents requires organizations and security firms to live by an assume breach mindset. Because there will always be another zero day, new evolving threat actor groups, and never before seen novel attacks and techniques. This assume breach mindset is a key foundation towards information sharing and ensuring in instances such as this that the internet remains safe. While Cloudflare was experiencing and mitigating these attacks, we were also working with industry partners to guarantee that the industry at large could withstand this attack. During the process of mitigating this attack, our Cloudflare team developed and purpose-built new technology to stop these attacks and further improve our own mitigations for this and other future attacks at massive scale. In other words, they learned that there was something that was able to get by their DDoS mitigations, and they needed to develop new technology to deal with it.
Boy, wouldn't you love to be a fly on the wall in the war room there when they get these, you know, emergencies and they all leap into action? I have to say, I mean, whatever they did wrong here, you got to credit them with really talented people doing.
I love Cloudflare.
Yeah,
I just wish they weren't calling it a 0-day vulnerability in HTTP2. It's not. It's a feature. But anyway, we'll get there in a second.
It is a vulnerability, however, a feature-rich vulnerability.
An exploitable feature.
That's a better phrase. Yeah, they should have said that.
Exploitable feature.
Yeah.
So they said these efforts that theirs have significantly increased our overall mitigation capabilities and resiliency. So, yes, we're now better than ever. They said if you're using Cloudflare, we're confident that you are now protected. Our team also alerted web server software partners who are developing patches to ensure this vulnerability cannot be exploited. Then they said check their websites for more information. Disclosures, they said, are never one and done. The lifeblood of Cloudflare is to ensure a better internet, which stems from instances such as these, when we have the opportunity to work with our industry partners and governments to ensure there are no widespread impacts on the internet, we're doing our part in increasing the cyber resiliency of every organization, no matter the size or the vertical. It may seem odd that Cloudflare was one of the first companies to witness these attacks. Why would threat actors attack a company that has some of the most robust defenses against DDoS attacks in the world? Well, they've answered their own question, and they're about to. The reality is that Cloudflare often sees attacks before they're turned on more vulnerable targets. Threat actors need to develop and test their tools before they deploy them in the wild. Threat actors who possess record-shattering attack methods can have an extremely difficult time testing and understanding how large and effective they are because they don't have the infrastructure to absorb the attacks they're launching. Because of the transparency that we share on our network performance and the measurements of attacks they could glean from our public performance charts, this threat actor was likely targeting us to understand the capabilities of this new exploit.
Oh.
And I think that's exactly right.
So we're just going to launch a small botnet against you just to see what you can do.
Yeah. Remember in the days when I was under attack, I had two T1s, which were each 1.54 megabits.
Right.
So a 3.4 megabit flood would swamp me. I mean, I was a gnat. I wasn't even worth swatting. So, it took nothing to knock me off the net.
But on the other hand, Cloudflare has terabytes of bandwidth.
Yes. Yeah, yes, it is very difficult to push them down.
Yeah.
But this attack did it initially.
Yeah.
They said, but that testing, meaning the bad guys testing, and the ability to see the attack early helps us develop mitigations for the attack that benefit both our customers and the industry as a whole. That is, they shared what they learned.
Both sides get information, the bad guys and the good guys. Yeah.
Yep. Even so, whether it was Log4j, SolarWinds, Eternal Blue, WannaCry, NotPetya, Heartbleed, or Shellshock, all of these security incidents have a commonality, a tremendous explosion that ripples across the world and creates an opportunity to completely disrupt any internet-dependent organization, regardless of the industry or the size. While we wish we could say that rapid reset may be different this time, it is not. We're calling all CSOs, no matter if you've lived through the decades of security incidents or this is your first day on the job, this is the time to ensure you're protected and stand up your cyber incident response team. We've kept the information restricted until today to give as many security vendors as possible the opportunity to react. However, at some point, the responsible thing becomes to publicly disclose zero-day threats like this. Today is that day. That means that after today, threat actors will largely be aware of the be aware of the HTTP2 vulnerability. Again, it's a feature that's exploitable, and it will inevitably become trivial to exploit and kick off the race between defenders and attackers. First to patch versus first to exploit. Organizations should assume that systems will be tested and take proactive measures to ensure protection. The guy wrote, "To me, this is reminiscent of a vulnerability like Log4j. Due to the many variants that are emerging daily and will continue to come to fruition in the weeks, months, and years to come. As more researchers and threat actors experiment with the," and they're calling it again a vulnerability, "we may find different variants with even shorter exploit cycles that contain even more advanced bypasses." I would argue against that, but we'll get to that in a minute. And they said, "And just like Log4j, managing incidents isn't as simple as run the patch, now you're done. You need to turn incident management, patching, and evolving your security protections into an ongoing process, because the patches for each variant of a vulnerability reduce your risk, but they don't eliminate it. We don't mean to be alarmist, but we'll be direct. You must take this seriously. Treat this as a full active incident to ensure nothing happens to your organization." Okay, so, you know, that's a little bit self-serving, since Cloudflare has just finished explaining that while they were initially caught off guard by this unanticipated and massive zero-day attack, they're now up to speed and are inviting everyone to come and hide behind their perimeter. On the other hand, they're offering it at no charge. They do offer the service for free. So they wrap this up by writing, "Cloudflare's mission is to help build a better internet. If you're concerned with your current state of DDoS protection, and if you weren't before, you should be now, we're more than happy to provide you with our DDoS capabilities and resilience for free to mitigate any attempts of a successful DDoS attack. We know the stress that you're facing, as we have fought off these attacks for the last 30 days and made our best, already best-in-class systems even better." Okay, so thank you very much. Now, even though this first posting of theirs didn't give us any of the meaty technical details that this podcast never shies away from, I wanted to share it since it's what Cloudflare is telling the entire world. And sharing it here is important because I believe, as I've said, that it mischaracterizes HTTP2 as having surprising and unsuspected vulnerabilities, which is not the case. We're going to get into the meaty details, Leo, after you tell us who's paying for them.
This is really fascinating. And, you know, I mean, the takeaway is, if this was a test with a small botnet, imagine what the traffic could be if they really targeted somebody. And, of course, there's some events coming up that are very commonly DDoSed, including the Super Bowl. It's very common to DDoS betting groups, or at least to extort them. That's the other reason. It's not just a test. It's also a note to companies that are, you know, getting ready for Black Friday, Prime Day, the Super Bowl betting, that we have the capability to shut you down on those days. And I think that that's a very clear message. And I'm sure that the security teams of those companies are sitting up and taking notice. It's hard to fix a feature.
Exactly.
Easier to fix a bug.
Exactly.
Wow. Hey, it's Cybersecurity Awareness Month. You're doing your bit by listening to Security Now. You might want to do some more by telling everybody you know. I know you use a password manager, but for crying out loud, get your family, your friends, your loved ones, your acquaintances, the guy down at the Chevron station, get them to start using a password manager, because passwordless is not here yet. And you still need a password manager on almost every site you visit. And there is one and only one password manager that I recommend Steve did his research. That's the one he moved to. I've been using it for some time. I'm a big fan. First of all, it's open source. And I really think that's important with any security program, is that you can see the source code, and maybe even more importantly, experts can see the source code and know what's going on. It's also completely cross-platform. It runs on Windows. It runs on Mac. It runs on Linux. It runs on iOS. It runs on Android. That's really important to me. I need to be able to use the same password manager everywhere, and Bitwarden's the one. Plus, it works at home and at the office. We love Bitwarden. We're migrating over to Bitwarden at Twit. I think almost all of our employees are already using Bitwarden personally. One of the reasons they do is because Bitwarden is free for personal use, free forever. I like to cut them a little money for their premium account, $10 a year, because I want to support them. And I talked to them. I said, now, we've had rug pulls before with companies that said, oh, try our free password service, and then say, well, we're not going to give you quite as much as we used to, or now you have to pay. Not Bitwarden. They told me, look, we're open source. We can't make it not free. So free forever for the personal account. Bitwarden does so many great things. For instance, if you have a personal account, you can use Bitwarden to host your vault. I do. I trust them to keep it safe. But as many have pointed out, that's not trust no one. That is a single point of failure. So host your own vault if you want. Host it on a cloud server, encrypt it, and then put it up there. Host it on your NAS. Host it on one machine, let the other machine sync. It's up to you, and you can do that with Bitwarden. With Bitwarden, every bit of data in your vault is password protected. Now, that's something not every password manager does. All the metadata. See, metadata is important. That metadata is almost as valuable, knowing what sites you visit, what sites you have an account with. That's really valuable. So Bitwarden encrypts it all. It's not possible to see it. Bitwarden is, I think, the good news is the word's getting out. In the summer 2023 G2 Enterprise Grid Report, Bitwarden was named the highest performing password manager for enterprise, leaving competitors in the dust. Bitwarden protects your data. They protect your privacy by adding strong, randomly generated passwords for each account. But they can do more. You can go farther with a username generator, create unique usernames for each account, or use any of the six integrated email alias services like Fastmail, one of our sponsors, and you can have a unique address. This is actually what I do for every site you visit. That makes it doubly harder for an attacker to figure out how to get into your account, because not only is the password unique, not used anywhere else, not used anywhere else. That's really important. But so is the email. So is the email. This is really great. You can log into Bitwarden and decrypt your vault after using SSO on a registered trusted device. That means you don't have to remember a master password anymore. Love that. This new solution makes it even easier for enterprise users to stay safe and secure with Bitwarden. Frankly, I think we should take credit for that, because we told them before we can move to Bitwarden at Twit as an enterprise solution, you got to have this. And now they do. Yay. Thank you, Bitwarden. You can see all of Bitwarden's code. When I say open source, it's all on GitHub. So you can see it. But also, Bitwarden has regular professional third-party audits performed every single year. And they publish the results on the website. They don't keep it a secret. So you can see. And in the past, yeah, this is good. The third-party audits have found issues. Bitwarden's fixed them like that. Bitwarden also allows our listeners... Quexton, who's a listener, said, you know, Bitwarden, PBKDF2 is fine for your hash, keyword hash. But what if we supported S-Crypt, which is memory hard and even better, or Argon2? He wrote implementations. After some conversation with Bitwarden, he issued a pull request. Everybody decided, let's work on Argon2. And within months of this issue coming up, Argon2 was available to every Bitwarden user. That's fantastic. I immediately switched to Argon2. That's one advantage open source can give you, right? You have a world of developers working for you. Bitwarden's great for the enterprise. You can share private data securely with coworkers across departments or the entire company. Fully customizable, adaptive plans. There's Bitwarden's Teams organization option. That's $3 per user per month. We're going to do the enterprise organization five plan. That's $5 per user per month. There's a family plan, gives up to six users. They don't even have to be blood relatives. It could be your chosen family. All those premium features for $3.33 a month for total. The free account's always free forever for unlimited passwords. I upgraded, as I said, to the premium account, $10 a year, because I wanted to support them as much as anything else. So, bottom line, this Cybersecurity Awareness Month, keep yourself, more importantly, I know you're safe. Keep your friends and family safe and secure. Teach them about Bitwarden. It's easy to use. It's got a fully featured free plan, so they can't say, oh, it costs too much. It's free for everyone. By the way, I really praise them for this. One of the reasons I decided to go premium is I want to use my YubiKey as my second factor. It's now part of the free program. So not only are they not taking away features, they're actually adding features to the unlimited free program. You can use hardware security keys and pass keys, yay, as your form of two-factor. Bitwarden was created with a vision of a world where no one is hacked. It's the only major password manager offering passwordless, you know, either hardware security keys or pass keys for your two-factor as a free forever option. So I love these people so much. I really appreciate what they've done. And now they've just gone the extra step. And that makes me really happy. And I'm still going to give you my $10 every month, or every year, I should say. It's nothing. It's less than $1 a month. At Twit, you know, at Security Now, we believe password managers are still vital. Until the world moves to Squirrel, Steve, we're going to have password managers. Get started with Bitwarden's free trial of a Teams or Enterprise plan right now, or get started for free across all devices as an individual user. And yes, you get passkeys or YubiKey if you want, or a security key. Bitwarden for free. Bitwarden.com/twit. Bitwarden.com/twit. I am a big fan. I use Bitwarden every day, and I thank my lucky stars when I pop up my iPhone and the Face ID goes, yep, it's you. And I use Bitwarden to log in, and it's so fast and so easy. Just makes me really happy. When I just got those two new phones, so easy to move over. The Pixel 8 Pro, Bitwarden is just, it's beautiful. Now it uses Face ID on the Pixel phones, which is really great, as well as fingerprint. I can go on and on. I will stop now because Steve has more to talk about. But get it, will you? Do us a favor. Bitwarden.com/twit. Do the world a favor. Be secure. All right. I am just blown away by this HTTP2 vulnerability that you say is a feature. This rapid reset is a feature,
so,
not a
yes.
bug.
Now we get to the meaty details. It is described in CVE 2023-44487. The CVE disclosure is a bit more fair, but even it contains a bit of spin and a little bit of misdirection. The description of the CVE states, quote, the HTTP2 protocol allows a denial of service, it says parens server resource consumption, because request cancellation can reset many streams quickly, as exploited in the wild in August through October of 2023. Okay, now, Google's summary of the problem is, I think, exactly correct. So here's what Google wrote. They said, since late 2021, okay, late 2021, so for the last 2 years almost, the majority of layer 7, meaning HTTP, you know, high-level, application-level, DDoS attacks we've observed across Google first-party services and Google Cloud projects protected by CloudArmor have been based on HTTP2, meaning so HTTP2 has become the preferred DDoS attack protocol. They said both by number of attacks and by peak request rates. A primary design goal of HTTP2 was efficiency. And unfortunately, and here it is, the features that make HTTP2 more efficient for legitimate clients can also be used to make DDoS attacks more efficient. So that's what it is. It's an abuse of the efficiency that HTTP2 offers. That is precisely the truth. The features that make HTTP2 more efficient for legitimate clients can also be used to make DDoS attacks more efficient. So, not any surprise zero-day vulnerability, just the clever abuse of a new feature of HTTP2 that anyone designing HTTP2-capable servers will need to take into account. Until now, Cloudflare hadn't. They'd been relying upon their conventional DDoS protections, which are doubtless very strong. But this new form of attack was too much even for that. But that said, I do agree with the creation of a CVE and the raising of alerts about this, since indeed rapid HTTP2 stream resets promise to cause some havoc with any HTTP2-capable web server that's not capable of handling these resets efficiently. To get some scope of the problem, switching back to Cloudflare for a minute, in their more technical write-up, they wrote, "Starting on August 25th, 2023, we started to notice some unusually big HTTP attacks hitting many of our customers. These attacks were detected and mitigated by our automated DDoS system. It was not long, however, before they started to reach record-breaking sizes and eventually peaked just above 200 million requests per second. This was nearly three times bigger than our previous biggest attack on record. Concerning is the fact that the attacker was able to generate such an attack with a botnet of merely," and unfortunately we're now using the word merely when we talk about 20,000, you know, consumer routers and other things that have been compromised.
I'll never forget, and this was 20 years ago at Tech TV, we had, I can't remember who was, one of our famous trained hackers come in and show us a IRC channel that was being used to control, for command and control of a botnet. And we're sitting here watching this IRC channel. I think this was right before they shut it down. This was law enforcement. But that just one after another, a compromised system announcing itself and effectively saying, you know, what is thy will, my master? You know, what do you want me to do? And they just all sit there in this IRC. I don't know if they still use IRC for this, but they just sit there waiting to be commanded.
Now, maybe you're remembering my write-up, because
maybe it was you. I don't know. I saw this happening, though.
Yeah.
I think it was on the set of the TV show.
Okay.
And I believe law enforcement brought it in.
Yeah. And I also saw the same thing, because I infiltrated the attacker's IRC channel, and I captured a screen of all these bots reporting for duty.
Yeah. This was 20 years ago. So it's been going on for a long time. Do they still use that kind of command and control, or do they have a more modern way?
I have no idea. I've been out of that specific loop.
Yeah.
So the Cloudflare guy said there are botnets today that are made up of hundreds of thousands or millions. And remember, this is a 20,000 machine attack. There are botnets with millions of machines. So imagine when those millions of botnets are updated with this attack. I mean, that's the meltdown event. I mean, it's whoa. So
we could see a world error here.
Given that the entire web tip, here's another really interesting metric. So this was 201 million RPS, requests per second. They wrote, given that the entire web typically sees only between 1 and 3 billion requests per second, it's not inconceivable that using this method could focus the entire global web's worth of requests onto a small number of targets.
Holy cow.
It's like focusing the sun,
God,
you know, onto, you know,
yeah, well, it's
Manhattan.
Like that. A man of magnifying glass with all that power into a pinpoint.
Yep.
Your server's going to melt.
It's going to melt. So just to be clear, since putting this into context is important, this attack by just 20,000 bots generated on its own a peak of 201 million requests per second, and the internet across its entire expansive whole sees between 1 and 3 billion requests per second. And whereas this breathtaking attack was produced by only 20,000 bots working in concert, botnets consisting of hundreds of thousands to millions of individual devices are known to exist. And as Cloudflare wrote in their less technical overview, as of last Tuesday, October 10th, every bad guy, bot operator, who may not have been in the loop until now, now knows about it. And it's a trivial attack to create. What's more, as Wikipedia told us, HTTP2 is offered as an available protocol by around 39% of the internet's web servers. We don't currently know what percentage of those web services poorly handle HTTP2 stream resets. It could be that cloud providers inherently have a greater problem with this due to their more highly distributed architecture. A single standalone HTTP2 server might now be much more affected by this than by an HTTP 1.1 request flood. Okay, however, unless and until any vulnerable web servers are updated and or moved behind some sort of perimeter protection, they're going to be at least in danger of exploitation from this novel server-side resource depletion attack. And what's significant is that this is true even from the great many more lesser bot operators who run much smaller botnets. Once the code to implement this attack has circulated throughout the underground, as I noted above, it's trivial to do this attack. And given how things are likely...
Out of curiosity, is it just a loop? Is it just like a couple of lines of code that says, send this reset request, rapid reset request to this server, and then go to 10?
That's
what
it is.
Is it basically that?
That's it.
I just implemented it.
Yep.
Good Lord.
Probably in Lisp, knowing you.
Yeah, I'll do it in Lisp. What is the command for rapid reset? Is it a straightforward command?
We're getting there.
Sorry. I'm getting excited.
Also dated last Tuesday the 10th was Cloudflare's posting titled HTTP2 Rapid Reset Deconstructing the Record-Breaking Attack. Their description begins, "This attack was made possible by abusing some features of the HTTP2 protocol and server implementation details." Now, see, and the techie guys are a little less hypey, and, you know, they're getting it right. So this is Cloudflare saying, "This attack was made possible by abusing some features of the HTTP2 protocol," not calling it a vulnerability,
yeah,
"and server implementation details."
I mean, to be fair, it's a feature, but it is also a vulnerability.
It's not a goodie.
If you had a soft spot at the top of your head,
yeah,
it's a feature, but I could also knock it.
Still a soft spot.
It's also a vulnerability. It's still a soft spot.
So they said, because the attack abuses an underlying weakness in the HTTP2 protocol, we believe any vendor that has implemented HTTP2 will be subject to the attack. This includes every modern web server. We, along with Google and AWS, have disclosed the attack method to web server vendors who we expect will implement patches. We'll see. I mean, there's not much you can do.
That's my question. Yeah.
Yeah. The best defense is using, of course, here they're going to sell themselves, although it is free, a DDoS mitigation service like Cloudflare's in front of any web-facing API or web server. Okay. Again, what exactly now is an HTTP2 stream reset? I could write this up myself, but in the interest of saving some time so that I have time to assemble other interesting things this week, because I did this first and then I did the user feedback, I'm going to switch to Google's explanation. I'm switching to Google because Cloudflare is pretty much unable to stop blaming this on HTTP2 and calling it a zero-day vulnerability. Google explains, HTTP2 uses streams, bidirectional abstractions used to transmit various messages or frames between the endpoints. Stream multiplexing is the core HTTP2 feature, which allows higher utilization of each TCP connection. streams are multiplexed in a way that can be tracked by both sides of the connection while only using one layer 4, meaning TCP, connection. Stream multiplexing enables clients to have multiple in-flight requests without managing multiple individual connections. Okay, now I'm gonna switch back and note that we talked about this a million years ago on the podcast. Well, okay, 2015. With HTTP 1.1, a single TCP connection can be created to a server and a client. It's able to send multiple queries to the server sequentially in a sort of pipeline, but the server must receive them in order and reply to each query in order so that the sequence of replies matches the sequence of queries. The big trouble with this is that many smaller and faster to answer queries could get held up behind an earlier query that takes a server more time to reply to. You know, perhaps it needs to query something else to obtain an answer. Meanwhile, some queries, like for simple images, for example, you know, little icons and embellishments, would be held up waiting behind the big slow query to be returned. When Google says that HTTP uses streams, they mean that ID tags are added to individual queries, and ID tags are returned with their matching replies. This creates a sort of parallel abstraction, where even though there's still only one connection, a highly capable HTTP server could accept every incoming query the moment it arrives, assign an independent task or thread to begin assembling each query's reply individually, and then send back that query's reply with its associated ID tag as soon as its reply is ready.
So that makes sense, because modern machines are multi-threaded.
Yes.
So they're not doing a single process anymore. That's ancient history.
Right.
So they could take advantage of that. A lot of programming languages have streams built in for this very reason.
Right.
Yeah.
So Google continues. They said, one of the main constraints when mounting a layer 7, meaning an HTTP level, you know, application level DOS attack, is the number of concurrent transport connections. Each connection carries a cost, including operating system memory for socket records and buffers, CPU time for the TLS handshake, as well as each connection needing a unique 4-tuple, that is the IP address and the port pair for each side of the connection, which constrains the number of concurrent connections between two IP addresses. In HTTP 1.1, each request is processed serially. The server will read a request, process it, write a response, and only then read and process the next request. In practice, this means that the rate of requests that can be sent over a single connection is one request per round trip, where a round trip includes the network latency, the proxy processing time, if there's a proxy, you know, in front, and back-end request processing times. While HTTP 1.1 pipelining is available in some clients and servers to increase a connection's throughput, it is not prevalent among legitimate clients. Now, I thought that was interesting. What Google just said was that while HTTP 1.1 does technically support allowing clients to send ahead queries, as I originally mentioned, in the process known as pipelining, in practice, that has not been ever been widely adopted, and now it won't be because HTTP 2 has come along now, and all the browsers do that. And the reason was it's a little scary to like send requests blind and just hope that the answers come back in the right sequence and you not get confused in counting them. Much cleaner if you tag them with individual IDs so you're sure about which query matches which request. So anyway, it wasn't widely adopted, So the clients wait until they receive the reply to their single outstanding query before they're comfortable to submit the next query, even though technically they could. Google says, with HTTP2, the client can open multiple concurrent streams. So again, get this, that a stream is just an abstraction in the same way that packets are an abstraction of a connection on the internet between two points. We say we're connected, but it's actually, you know, a stream of packets. Similarly, the streams are an abstraction of multiple concurrent connections over a single TCP connection. So they said each stream corresponding to one HTTP request. The maximum number of concurrent open streams is, in theory, controllable by the server, but in practice, clients, here it is, may open 100 streams per connection, and the servers process these requests in parallel, meaning that a client could connect using TCP, bring up a TLS connection to go HTTPS, when the server has responded, it'll say that it is able to handle HTTP2. So the client says, great. It then basically just pours as many queries for items on the server into this connection as possible, giving each one a unique ID tag, knowing that when as the server is able to handle them, and in any order that the server may choose, it will start sending the replies back tagged with the same ID as the query that it generated. So, and 100 of them can be outstanding at once. You can just pour 100 in. So Google said, for example, the client can open 100 streams and send a request on each of them in a single round trip. The proxy, which is the front end to a cloud service, will read and process each stream serially, but the requests to the back end servers can again be parallelized. The client can then open new streams as it receives responses to the previous ones, meaning it can always have 100 of them outstanding, 100 pieces of work to be done. So as streams complete by the reply coming back, that says, oh, there's room for another stream, and so it just immediately emits another query. So Google says this gives an effective throughput for a single connection of 100 requests per round trip, with similar round trip timing constants to HTTP 1.1 requests. This will typically lead to almost 100 times higher utilization of each connection. Okay, so this is where, why, and how HTTP 2 offers potentially far greater performance over HTTP 1.1. HTTP 2 solicits clients, our web browsers, to dump all their queries into a single connection at once. Since it's just a single TCP connection, they cannot actually move across the wire simultaneously, but they can be queued up and sent, so they're packed very tightly, and so that fewer, small, and less efficient packets are sent. Remember, we talked about this back then. If you send small queries, then you're only using a part of a packet, yet you're still having to switch and route an entire packet. If instead you're able to pack queries literally where the last byte of one starts with the first byte of the next, then all your packets are full, and so all of your switching and your packet processing rate is all, you know, also benefits. I mean, it's really the way that this should have been done, but you know, it was simple back then, and as I said a couple of weeks ago, nothing is simple anymore, unfortunately. It's all getting complicated. So anyway, assuming that the back end has sufficient parallel serving capability, all of the then outstanding replies can be assembled in any order. The moment a reply is ready, it's queued up for return to the client with its ID tag identifying which query it's the reply for. It is beautiful and elegant. And, you know, It is a future that is here. Unfortunately, it can be abused like nothing else ever has been. So note that the most modern pre-existing high request rate attacks are already leveraging this parallel streaming capability. As Google said, since 2021, the largest attacks we've been seeing are HTTP2 because they're using these streams in order to make this happen. So it HTTP2 already required or allowed much higher request rates than were possible under HTTP 1 or 1.1. But now, here's what you've been waiting for. The problem that's created by the new abuse of this fancy parallel architecture. Google writes, the HTTP 2 protocol allows clients to indicate to the server that a previous stream should be canceled by sending a reset stream frame. That's all you need to do at the client end. You just send a
reset.
What's
wrong with that?
Yeah. Basically, never mind.
Yeah.
You send a never mind stream.
Never mind. Forget I asked.
Yep. The protocol does not require the client and server to coordinate the cancellation in any way, meaning there's no need for it to be confirmed. TCP automatically gives us reliable transport. So TCP's got that covered. If the client sends a reset stream frame, it can assume the server has, and it is then able, that frees up one of its 100 for another query. Thus, the client can do this unilaterally. The client may also assume that the cancellation will take effect immediately when the server receives the reset stream frame before any other data from that TCP connection is processed. Google says this attack is called rapid reset because it relies upon the ability for an endpoint to send a reset stream frame immediately after sending a request frame, which makes the other endpoint start working and then rapidly resets the request. The request is canceled, but leaves the HTTP 2 connection open for additional requests and cancellations. Therefore, the HTTP 2 rapid reset attack, which is enabled by this capability, is simple, says Google. The client opens a large number of streams at once, as in the standard HTTP 2 DDoS attack. But rather than waiting for a response to each request stream from the server or the proxy, the client cancels each request immediately. And since HTTP 2 specifies that the client may assume that any canceled stream is immediately available for another request, the HTTP abusing attacker may immediately follow a stream reset with another new request using the same stream. The ability to reset streams immediately allows each connection to have an indefinite number of requests in flight. By explicitly canceling the requests, the attacker never exceeds the limit on the number of concurrent open streams, which is typically 100. The number of in-flight requests is no longer dependent on the round-trip time, but only on the available network bandwidth. In a typical HTTP 2 server implementation, the server will still have to do significant amounts of work for canceled resets, such as allocating new stream data structures, parsing the query, and doing header decompression, and mapping the URL to a resource. Moreover, in reverse proxy implementations, the request may be proxied to the back-end server before the reset stream frame is processed. This requires the proxy to then forward the stream reset to the appropriate back-end server. By comparison, the attacking client has almost no cost for sending the requests. This creates an exploitable cost asymmetry between the server and the client.
Oh, I was just saying, there's the problem, clearly.
Yep, exactly.
Right? It's a problem with spam. It costs them nothing to send it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so another advantage the attacker gains is that the explicit cancellation requests immediately after creation means that a reverse proxy server, which is what Cloudflare has on their perimeter and all the big cloud providers do, won't send a response to any of the requests. Canceling the requests before a response is returned thus reduces the returning bandwidth to the attacker, meaning the upstream back to the attacker won't get clogged up with much bigger replies since they've been canceled. So all of the work is loaded onto the servers with very little traffic returning. Although it's diabolical, it's not a flaw in HTTP2. It's just an abuse of a deliberate design feature. So what does Google recommend? They begin by explaining. They said, we don't expect that simply blocking individual stream requests is a viable mitigation against this class of attacks. Instead, the entire TCP connection needs to be closed when abuse is detected. Get this. HTTP2, they wrote, provides built-in support for closing connections using the go-away frame. You gotta love that. The designers of the HTTP2 protocol defined a go-away frame that could be sent back up the link to the client, telling it to, well, go away. Google says, the RFC defines a process for gracefully closing a connection that involves first sending an informational go away that does not set a limit on opening new streams, and one round trip later sending another that forbids opening additional streams. So there is a process basically for allowing the client to gracefully shut down rather than just terminate all of its pending queries. However, they said that this graceful go-away process is usually not implemented in a way which is robust against malicious clients.
Whoops. Well, we got to work on that.
So that maybe we're gonna see about fixing that.
We need a graceful go-away for sure.
This form of mitigation leaves the connection vulnerable to rapid reset attacks for too long and should not be used for building mitigations, as it does not stop the inbound requests. Instead, the go-away should be set up to limit stream creation immediately. So maybe we will see an HTTP 2.1 that will tweak the definition of this. They wrote, this leaves the question of deciding which connections are abusive. A client which cancels requests is not inherently abusive. The feature exists in the HTTP2 protocol to help better manage request processing. Typical situations, says Google, are when a browser no longer needs resources it had requested due to the user, for example, navigating away from the page, or applications using a long polling approach with a client-side timeout. Mitigations, or, you know, maybe when you've got multiple mouse pointers and they're in disagreement about what should be done next.
There's a good reason for that browser.
Mitigations for this attack, they said, can take multiple forms, but mostly center around tracking connection statistics, basically detecting abuse, and using various signals and business logic to determine how useful each connection is. For example, if a connection has more than 100 requests with more than 50% of the given requests canceled, it could be a candidate for a mitigation response. The magnitude and type of response depends on the risk to each platform, but responses can range from forceful go-away frames, as discussed before, to closing the TCP connection immediately. Okay, just, you know, hanging up. To mitigate, basically go away, then hang up. To mitigate against the non-canceling variant of this attack, we recommend that HTTP2 servers should close connections that exceed the concurrent stream limit. This can be either immediately or after some small number of repeat offenses. So,
in other words, there's a fingerprint for this kind of attack.
Yeah.
You can immediately
attack. It's very obvious if like every request is immediately being canceled, you know, I'd hang up on that jerk immediately.
Yeah. Well, that's good news. I mean,
Oh, yeah. So that's the story. Exactly as Google initially characterized the problem, the deliberate design decision of HTTP2, which can be used to significantly increase its efficiency and does increase its efficiency, can also be used to significantly increase the potency, the potential and the potency of DDoS attacks. Attackers figured out that rather than using HTTP2 simply to simultaneously ask for tons of resources and then be flooded by their return, they could instead immediately cancel their request and reissue another. Against this threat, today's servers, especially those in the cloud, which have distributed their request handling among multiple back-end components, which might make canceling those issued requests much more tricky because those also have to be distributed, make it more time-consuming, would be seriously taxed by this new attack strategy. It'll be interesting to see whether anything could be done to change HTTP2 to prevent or limit this abuse. At the moment, the various servers are testing themselves and modestly tweaking their request handling to do a less bad job of dealing with this abuse of this HTTP2 future. Since, as I mentioned above, it's not possible to spoof the IP addresses of anything that's writing on top of TCP, the best solution might be to dynamically blacklist or at least significantly throttle any IP that is found to be abusing HTTP2 rapid reset. And that way, the bots would be recognized and quickly ignored at the perimeter of a large hosting provider like Cloudflare.
We do something like that all the time with password mitigation, right? You don't let somebody log in. My light just went out 10 times. That's a sign, isn't it? You don't let somebody log in an infinite number of times, one after the other. And, you know, in many cases, you just say, you know, oh, 6 times you're out or 10 times you're out. Yep. So this would be a simple mitigation. It doesn't change the protocol, though, right? It changes the way the server operates.
Exactly. Or,
yeah. I feel like this is a really good example of, and I'm sure these days when you're at an IETF meeting or a W3C meeting and they propose these protocols, they've hammer on, you know, they try to think of ways people would take advantage of it. And somebody just forgot to say, oh, you know, somebody could just keep sending rapid resets and it would overwhelm us because we'll start a million threads per user. We should build into the protocol there's a limit or, you know.
Right.
And they just didn't. They missed it. That happens.
Right.
It's not that the feature is a bad feature, right? I mean, the idea of these with a well-behaved client is fine.
Well, and consider that this is 8 years old. That is the protocol.
It just took them a while.
It took them this long it took the bad guys this long right. to go, hey, you know.
So I'm not surprised that a bunch of engineers didn't figure it out in 6 months. Right?
Our attack, we're only able to have a 100 concurrent outstanding requests. So we're having to wait for the replies to come back to free up a stream.
Yeah.
So why don't we just cancel that request? Then we don't have to wait for the answer.
Yeah. And it's pretty, I think it would be pretty easy to spot somebody behaving badly. That there would be, I guess the key is that there's enough distinction between a well-behaved user. This is the problem. If it's not distinct, yes. You don't want to hang up on, well, this is why SYNACS work, because you can't tell the difference between somebody who's sending you a reasonable SYN and somebody who doesn't care. But if you could tell the difference between a bad actor and a normal user pretty readily, which it sounds like you could, I think mitigation might be doable.
And here's where the term heuristic comes to our
that's a heuristic,
aid.
Isn't it?
You know, we would be using a heuristic. We would say, you know, we've done stats on, you know, for like the last month on all of the HTTP2 connections. We've never seen more than 5%
exactly
rapid resets.
Yeah.
So if anybody does 25, you know, they don't deserve our attention today.
Right. You always want to have it so that legitimate, it's like spam fighting.
Yep.
You don't want false positives. So you want the legitimate users who are doing things right, but maybe are demanding.
Yeah, I mean, how many times do we ask, or is someone required to say, if you didn't get our email, check your spam folder?
Yeah.
Because, you wanted, presumably you wanted that because you were talking to them, but it, it got routed into spam because, unfortunately, we've you're, again, a heuristic that is not sharp enough.
Yeah, it was too aggressive. This one seems like it would be doable, but maybe, I don't know.
Well,
maybe it's not.
And that's, I'm sure, what the server vendors are scurrying around
doing
in anticipation of this. And I should mention that all of these servers have the ability to turn off this protocol. So if you were at your own HTTP2 site and you were being attacked, just tell your server to turn off support for HTTP2, be a 1.1 server. And yes, your performance will drop, but it's better than being held off the internet by one pissed off bot.
It really drops when you get 20,000 people doing hundreds of requests.
I mean, I wouldn't be at all surprised if one attacker could not hold, not Cloudflare, but a standard website with no upfront protection.
Well, and a static site like mine, for instance, I'm not worried about mine being DDoS, but a static site like mine, for instance, I don't need HTTP 2.
No.
HTTP 1.1 would be fine.
Yep.
I'm using Nginx. Is Nginx one of these server?
Yes, Nginx is great, and they are working on a mitigation.
We use a DOS mitigation on our site, but I won't tell you by whom, not Cloudflare. But there's a lot of companies that offer DOS mitigation, DDoS mitigation.
Anybody who is curious could follow your traffic.
I guess it wouldn't be hard to figure out.
Your DOS mitigator.
All right, Steve, what a great, great topic. Maybe I was more engaged because they weren't feeding me and asking me questions and saying, Leo, can you come down the hall and check on this? So maybe I was more engaged. But what a good, I think a really good show, really good
topic. Yeah, well, and I think it's important for us all to note that there is now a new DDoS technology, a way of doing a DDoS that is effective against the latest HTTP2 protocol, which nearly 40% of the web, 39% of the web is using.
And maybe there's something with 3 too. We should probably look at all 3 of them.
Yes, that was addressed, and the presumption is that 3 won't be subject to the same problem.
Interesting. I imagine probably
because it's on top of QUIC instead of on top of TCP.
Oh, okay. How interesting.
Yeah.
Maybe that's this topic for another day.
We will see.
Will we get back to the top 10 mitigations next week?
Assuming that nothing else melts down between now and next Tuesday, we will finish up with part 2 of the top 10 cybersecurity misconfigurations.
Bad guys permitting. As always on this show. Steve Gibson's at grc.com. That's where you'll find ValiDrive. That's where you'll find the world's best mass storage maintenance and recovery utility, SpinRite 6.6.1, on its way. And as Steve mentioned today, you can get a copy of it right now. If you're a 6.0 user, you can get a beta copy of it. So if you've got some need to run it, this is the time. GRC.com. While you're there, of course, you could pick up a copy of this show. Steve has the usual 64 kilobit audio, but he also has a couple of unique formats, a 16 kilobit audio for the bandwidth impaired, and really well done transcripts by Elaine Ferris. She writes out every and ow, and probably got a few coughs in there a second ago. Leo coughs. I'll have to look at the transcript later. That's all at grc.com. You don't have to use X to message Steve. You can do it at GRC, grc.com/feedback. It's an old school post and get HTTP 1.1 form, but it'll work just fine. You're not using streams on your site, are you?
Nope.
No, of course not. It's a static site. You don't. It just sits there waiting. It's HTML, baby. We also have the show 64 kilobit audio at our website, twit.tv slash SN. We do have video too, though. If you want to see the video of my mom's house, you can see that. I don't know if you noticed it got dark as the show progressed.
Yeah.
You know? It's interesting, isn't it? Yeah. I opened the shutters. For a while, you could see the houses and the trees, but now it's just dark out there. Video and all of that available, and show notes, too, at both sites, twit.tv/SN or grc.com. He doesn't have the video. We do. If you want to watch us do this live, we do Security Now every Tuesday, around about 1:30 Pacific. That's 4:30 Eastern time in the afternoon. And that's 20:30 UTC. The live streams, audio and video, are at live.twit.tv. If you're watching live, chat live with us. Of course, our club members have the special velvet rope gated access to the Discord. The rest of the unwashed masses, you're welcome to use IRC. Actually, we don't judge. We don't judge. Somebody in IRC said, and I have to assure you this is not the case, I could just see Security Now going behind a paywall. Over my dead body, I think this is, of all the shows, this is the last one that would ever go behind a paywall. We don't, it's not our intention to put a paywall up. I hate paywalls. I don't think they serve anybody. So the shows that have been free all along will continue to be free all along, ad-supported. You know, we have some paywalled shows in the club, but that's because the club pays for them, in effect. And if enough people listen in the club and we can get some advertisers, we'll absolutely put it out as an ad-supported free version. So I'm a strong believer in ad-supported free. Don't worry, Security Now is not going behind a paywall. Not anytime soon, anyway. I don't think Steve would allow it, frankly. So forget what I say. What else should we say, Steve? I guess.
How about goodbye?
Goodbye would be a good one. Get the show on the website. There's a YouTube channel. Subscribe in your favorite podcast. Whatever you do, make sure you listen every single week. You do not want to miss an episode. And we'll see you next time on Security Now.
And you're back in the shop next week.
I'll be
right?
back next week. Absolutely.
Okay. Cool.
Come join us on This Week in Enterprise. Tech expert Kos and I talk about the enterprise world, and we're joined by industry professionals and trailblazers like CEOs, CIOs, CTOs, CISOs, every acronym role, plus IT pros and marketeers. We talk about technology, software plus services, security, you name it, everything under the sun. You know what? I learn something each and every week, and I bet you will too. So definitely join us. And of course, check out the twit.tv website and click on This Week in Enterprise Tech. Subscribe today. Security.